You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 30th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, Steve.
Yes.
Gene Wilder, one of my favorite comedic actors, died.
Yeah.
So sad.
I was sad to hear about that, too.
Starred in The Producers, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Young Frankenstein.
Blazing Saddles.
I know. He was in the sweet spot there for a while. And, you know, the thing that makes me sad about it is the guy lived 45 minutes from here. And I couldn't.
Really?
Tried to see him 10 years ago. I probably could have met him if I wanted to. And I just, you know, it would have been awesome because he just really was one of those people from my childhood that he was what funny was.
It was Alzheimer's, right?
Yeah. So he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's apparently at 3 years ago at 80 years old. He died at 83 of complication of Alzheimer's. The family kept it a secret. So it was just announced now, just as when his death was announced. Nobody knew he had Alzheimer's before that. And his relatives explained that the reason for the secrecy was because, like, every time Gene Wilder was in public and children would see him, like, they would smile and light up because I guess they would think that he's like Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka.
And he didn't want that experience for the children to be tainted by, like, their parents explaining to them that he's sick or something, you know. So he just wanted to keep that a secret.
Oh.
Yeah, so sad that's and really sweet awesome. At the same time.
Yeah. But that was my favorite role of his was Willy Wonka because he was brilliant in that role. You know, the remake with
Johnny Depp. Yeah,
Johnny Depp was horrible.
Terrible. You know, it was rough to watch.
It was, in my opinion.
Bob, come on.
It had a few moments of some chuckle.
There was some good stuff in there, but I mean, the Gene Wilder's performance as Willy Wonka was hard to beat, and it just didn't work. In my opinion, the remake just didn't work.
Yeah, because Gene Wilder was like, you know, all of the things that you think of when you think of Willy Wonka, like whimsical and fantastic, but there was like a darkness in it. There was definitely that undercurrent that made it kind of high and low at the same time, which is hard to do.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, did you know that he was largely responsible for Young Frankenstein, it was his idea, and he worked on it.
Really?
Yep.
I love that movie.
He had to convince Mel Brooks to do it, and, you know, he wrote, you know, I don't think he wrote all of it, but he definitely, like, mapped it out. You know, that was his baby, and that was really the thing that put him on the map. That movie was a huge success when it came out. And, you know, Willy Wonka, I loved, absolutely love it, but to me, he's Young Frankenstein.
That was a hilarious movie. That's a family favorite, actually, the Young Frankenstein.
I think it's
one of those movies we can quote from beginning to end.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I think we should all get together and watch that in his honor soon because we used to do it regularly. A few times a year, we'd watch Young Frankenstein. We haven't done it in like two dogs' ages.
14 years?
Yeah, that was a staple of my childhood. Do you guys know when that came out?
70s, I'd say mid-70s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, 74.
That's a guess.
So anyway, thank you, Gene. You really were a huge part of my childhood. I can't, you know, it just sucks when you lose someone like that, even if I never knew them.
All right, well, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Surely. For this week, I'm covering Peter Fleming. He is a UK pediatrician and professor, and he was the critical researcher who showed a link between an infant's sleeping position and sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. He probably saved many thousands upon thousands of babies' lives. So you don't hear about it much anymore, but when I was kind of growing up, SIDS was all over the news in the 70s and 80s. And 90s, between 1970 and 1991, we were at its worst, losing one baby in 250 live births a year, which is horrific. It was called by a U.S. congressional committee in the 70s one of the last great unresolved childhood catastrophes, and it really was. Fleming was looking into this, and ironically, he didn't look specifically at sleeping position. He was interested more in other variables like temperature and infection, but other researchers didn't have any data on it, but based on their observational studies, they thought there might be something to that, to the sleeping position. So Fleming included that variable in his experiment, if only to specifically exclude it. I don't think he would have expected, nor would a lot of other medical professionals at that time as well. The results weren't spectacular initially, but they looked promising. But he then talked to scores and scores of parents who lost a baby to SIDS in the UK, and he gathered lots of this real-world data all the time. And then finally, when he had enough results worthy of presenting them, the professionals were found it hard to believe. And as you can imagine, how could something so small and easy make such a huge difference? It just didn't make sense to a lot of people. But after that, the data gathering continued by his team and other teams, and soon they had what they really wanted and needed all along, and that was a call for funds for a public campaign, and they got that in 1991. It was called the Back to Sleep Campaign, and when it was launched, the change was so swift that the public health benefit was compared to another breakthrough that came to mind at the time. There was a Victorian epidemiologist, and his name was John Snow, which is hilarious.
yeah, but he knows nothing, that guy.
Nice. I was looking for a damn quote to throw in there. Good one. He removed the handle on a specific Soho water pump in 1854 and essentially stopped a cholera outbreak in its tracks.
That's good work, boys.
Yes. So to put it in perspective, in 1989, there were 1,545 SIDS deaths in the UK. I believe that's where that came from. Now there's barely 200 a year, and Fleming was key in making that happen. The drop was precipitous. So remember Peter Fleming and all the other researchers who made this happen. Mention him to your baby when he or she wakes up in the morning.
Aww.
So, you know, a lot of anti-vaxxers say that SIDS is due to vaccines.
Of course they'll say that. Mm-hmm. So won't they?
It's just a coincidence that, you know, the rate dropped, because of Fleming's.
Turning babies over.
Yeah, turning babies over. Just,
I actually had a cousin die of SIDS. Did you guys, do you guys know anybody in your family? I mean, it was around that era. She was a little younger than me, I think, but around when I was still like quite young. So I don't remember it per se, but they, you know, it was an infant and they buried her. We can visit her grave. And, you know, my two cousins have lost their little sister. And it was, like you said, Bob, it was really common in the 80s.
Sure.
That's when it was, you know, people just didn't know. I mean, it still happens, and it's still, I think, a bit of a mystery, but the fact that is such a contributing factor and that it was discovered is huge.
All right, let's move on to some news items. Jay, you're going to start off with a recent NASA study that is getting us one step closer to getting people on Mars. Tell us about it.
Yes, there is a mission that just ended, and it ended on August 29th. A team of six people entered a Mars simulation in Hawaii on August 29th, 2015. And it ended on yesterday, actually, our time. We're recording this on Tuesday, the 30th. So they consisted of a French astrobiologist, a German physicist, and the other four were Americans. So there was a pilot, an architect, a journalist, and a soil scientist. This was a NASA-funded study, and it was run by the University of Hawaii. And it's the second longest mission like this ever conducted. Do you guys know what the longest one was?
520 days, just random guess.
Five something.
Very good. It was a Russian mission that lasted 520 days. Suck. It was located. This mission was located on the slopes of Mauna Loa on the island of Hawaii.
Mauna Loa, right?
Mauna Loa, okay.
Yeah, Maunaloa.
Thank you, Kara. Yeah. So this mission was part of the High Seas program, the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. So as of yesterday, it was a full year that they lived in these very tight quarters. If you can, look at the pictures and you'll see, like, it's pretty tight. It wasn't like extraordinarily tight. The domed structure they were in had a high ceiling, so they got a little like sense of space. But on top of the tight quarters, they didn't have fresh food or fresh air or even that much privacy. everything was, they had to be rationed, you know. The Mount Loa slopes were actually Mars-like. You know, there wasn't a lot, there was no vegetation in the pictures that I saw. So they picked this location because it was kind of on, you know, like volcanic rock and that type of thing to give them the sense of like the dreariness of Mars. So there was a video of the crew coming out of their habitat, right? I don't know if you guys saw it. And I was surprised at how they were just not incredibly excited. And it, at least they didn't look that way. You know, I would have been running out of this habitat nude with sparklers attached to my shoulders. I would have been screaming like, whoa! You know, but they just kind of come out and they're like smiling and they looked tired. So I think it was hard. You know, I could just see it on their faces. This was a hard thing to do. It was also reported that the crew wasted no time eating like the foods that they missed, which two things I read were pizza and bananas, which, you know, I love both of those, so I can get that. Pizza, definitely. The mission commander, Carmel Johnston, commented that their lack of privacy was very difficult. And I can only imagine being in such small quarters with, you know, five other people doing the same thing day in and day out for 11 years, just recording the same podcast over and over with no mention of all the other things that I love. So she said, it's kind of like having roommates that just are always there and you could never escape them. So I'm sure some people can imagine what it is like. And if you can't, then just imagine never being able to get away from anybody.
Now, I imagine any crew going to Mars is going to have a damn sophisticated VR system that goes with them so
right?
that they can kind of beat that sort of insanity that would otherwise settle
Isn't that a no-brainer? You never hear anyone talk about that.
There's no way that they're not going to send them with the virtual reality headsets. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Of course they will. Give them all the virtual sense of space that they need. It's, you know, the technology is here. It's great.
Yeah, but there's one problem that won't solve.
What?
If you don't have the privacy, there's no, you know.
They had a bathroom in this experiment. They could go in the bathroom and hang out.
I guess so.
So they were, like I said, they were allowed to travel outside the dome, but they need to have a separate
porn room, basically.
this little hut, a secondary hut out there.
Yeah.
They could call it the putt hut.
The J.O. station.
Guys.
The whatever station.
Yeah. My friend Christine Corbett Moran, she is at the Antarctic Research Station right now. She's a physicist working down there. And she just tweeted earlier today, for whatever reason, there are about 50 copies of this book on the South Pole Station. And it's a book titled Dealing with People You Can't Stand.
and how to serve them for dinner. Yeah.
Well, that's no joke, though. Jeez. Seriously, Kara, they were researching this because they wanted to see how the crew would work together, how they got along, how to pick crew members. It's also there to help the scientists understand how, like, the isolation of a deep space mission would impact human participants. Like, this was really what this whole mission was about.
Yeah.
And this was actually on the short side for what the real mission would be like. Now, let's think about it. They were in there a year, and the shortest travel time to Mars is about a year. It could be up to 3 years, though, to get to Mars. That's a long haul.
Yeah.
And that's not even being there. That's just getting there. You know, then you're there. You know, who knows what the habitat's going to be like. And they, like I said, they had to ration all their food and resources on this mission. So, I think they got a sense of like, okay, this is what it would kind of be like. They each had a small sleeping cot and a desk inside of their rooms. I think they did have like just these tiny little privacy rooms.
There's a picture of the inside on the article, and it looks like there are this array of tiny rooms.
Very tiny, like smaller than a small bathroom.
Yeah,
provisions included. I'm sure this was not the whole list, but the two things I found was they had powdered cheese and canned tuna. So a few more facts. These are interesting. They had, of course, limited contact with friends, family, and the outside world. If they did talk to anyone outside of the habitat that wasn't on the mission, there was a 20-minute delay that simulated deep space communication.
Sure.
This habitat was very self-sufficient. And one last cool thing, anybody out there, if you're looking to get into the next group of rats, I mean explorers, for their next two isolation missions, you could go, those missions start next year and the following year for the two next missions, and you can learn how to apply at the project's announcement website. So just look up HiSeas mission, and you should be able to find a link to that application. They're due by September 5th, so hurry up if you want to get included.
All right, thanks, Jay. Kara, I'm confused about this next item. Straighten me out.
This week, about 2 days ago, actually, an article was authored by Brad Stulberg in New York Magazine. So you may have come across it. And it makes some pretty convincing arguments as to why we should question the hype around workouts that specifically focus on what's been dubbed muscle confusion, or kind of constantly switching up your workout to increase its effectiveness. Have you guys heard of this? You know, programs like P90X utilize this. You know, always try something new. Every day should be different.
It used to be preached sometimes in the martial arts studio that I would attend regularly, that was part of the fitness aspect of it, is creating muscle confusion.
Muscle confusion. Yeah, I've heard that term a lot. There's, you know, P90X, all those different programs kind of utilize that as a core tenet. And there's also something called ClassPass. I don't know if you guys have come across ClassPass. It's very trendy out here in LA, where people can buy it. And it basically means they can sample all these different types of exercise classes. You know, he quotes a bunch of people in this article basically saying this is a total myth. And there are all these elite trainers that he talks to that call it garbage. They call it nonsense. And even one individual calls it, quote, being in an open relationship with exercise, which is not very effective. So the main questions are, A, why is it garbage? And B, if it really doesn't work, why is it such a popular myth? Like, why does it stick around? So to answer the first question, why is it garbage? It seems to be the case that it flies in the face of an exercise regimen that does work and has a lot of research, actually decades of research to back it up. And that one's called progressive overload. I know it well because it's how I've trained throughout the years with a bunch of like evidence-based trainers that I've sought out. So what you do is you target specific muscle groups through repetitive activity, lifting, stretching, pushing, pulling, whatever, and then you rest and recover, and then you do it again. And then you do it again over and over and over. And as you continue kind of on this slow and steady path, you notice that the specific exercises you're doing start to feel easier. The weight starts to feel lighter. You don't fail when you're doing, you know, your reps. So that's when you up it and you do the whole thing over again. You up your weight, you up the intensity. And it takes months. It takes years. You just keep slow and steady down this path, upping the weight, upping the intensity, upping the resistance as your body adapts and as your muscles actually physically change. It does work, and it works so much so that in 2002, the American College of Sports Medicine published a position paper in their peer-reviewed flagship journal, Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise. Their position, quote, progression models in resistance training for healthy adults. The whole article is about that and about that's what works. It's the only approach that shows consistent increases both in strength and in muscle size. A more recent study that was published in 2015 in the journal Frontiers in Physiology actually highlights the fact that the vast, vast, vast majority of elite athletes, like professionals, you know, in the NFL or the NBA, also Olympians, professional cyclists, things like that, they all use progressive overload. The study is actually mainly focused on detailing the logistics and the parameters of progressive overload, because it's almost like a foundational assumption in this study, where they detailed the sort of specific exercise routine of multiple elite athletes.
What about bodybuilders themselves? I mean, they're, I think, a key demographic, if you want to call that. I don't think you could find one bodybuilder ever that didn't reach his level, you know, of muscularity without using some variation of progressive overload. I mean, that's
for sure. Yeah, they're not doing P90X to get jacked like that.
No,
I mean, they might not be using legal substances either, but yeah, in addition to any of their enhancements, yeah, it's slow and steady work. It's pushing, pushing, pushing the same muscles over and over. And bodybuilders, of course, know exactly which muscles they're trying to target. They do routines that specifically target the muscles that they feel aren't, you know, popping out the way that they should or looking the way that they want them to. And they'll target those and push and push and push until the weight gets lighter. And then they'll up their weight and push and push and push. So there's decades of research showing that progressive overload is a more scientifically sound approach. There's almost no research confirming that this idea of muscle confusion, A, works, or that even the title means anything. Like, your muscles, can muscles be confused? So I guess the question is, why is there so much hype? Why do so many people sign up for, you know, P90X?
Marketing?
Marketing is a big one. And it also looks like it's a function of kind of our own sort of intrinsic needs, goals, wants, and the way that society is shifting. You know, the author posits that and he uses a lot of supporting evidence from other areas, we like instant gratification. He cites studies that show the expected download time of a web page has increased significantly over the years. We don't like slow. We don't like monotonous. We don't like it when progress isn't readily apparent. We like change and novelty. And the truth of the matter is that can be a good thing sometimes in the short term, which can trick you, right? If you're doing P90X, you might see results immediately and be like, oh my God, this works. This is what I need to do. I need to confuse my muscles because I'm actually losing weight and getting stronger. But the truth of the matter is moving around and doing exercise works if you've been sedentary. Of course, any type of exercise is going to have a significant effect if you've been sedentary. Any sort of intense change to your routine is going to have effects. The problem is they don't stay.
If you're a beginner, the changes that happen are more quick and more profound than if you're a seasoned athlete.
Oh, for sure.
So, yeah, beginners can be like, whoa, even after just a week or two, like, damn, look at these changes. So, yeah, that's a factor as well.
Yeah, elite athletes, everybody hits these walls where it feels like you're just going through the motions and nothing's happening. You're not seeing results anymore, but this slow and steady race does actually show results, at least in the literature. So, you know, I think this is like an intrinsic function of being human, this idea that we're really good at affecting change. We're not good at sticking with the patterns to make sure that the change is a new routine. I'm actually really reminded of just yesterday, 2 days ago maybe, I finished the most recent book I read, Complications by Atul Gawande, which is, you know, about his time as a surgical resident. And he dedicates a whole chapter to the gastric bypass procedure and really candidly talks about weight loss in that chapter. And he talks about how people just suck at losing weight. They just suck at it. We're really good at losing it immediately. We can, you know, lose sometimes hundreds of pounds and rapidly if we try really hard. But people almost never keep that weight off, to the extent that some people have to have their stomachs reduced, physically reduced by surgery, and bypass the top of their small intestine just to regain hope of like not being morbidly obese and living healthily. And even still, a small but steady portion of these patients somehow manage to gain all their weight back, even with the physical restraints of having a significantly smaller area to put that food. We're just really bad at making a change and then sticking with that change. And also, I mean, I think we'd all agree that we're not evolutionarily equipped for abundance, right? We didn't adapt in an environment in which we had high caloric foods within arm's reach constantly. We're not, you know, our bodies don't work with such abundance. And we like things to be fast and easy. So, you know, I think patience is obviously a virtue, even in exercise. And I would actually be really interested to see some correlative studies between individuals who use progressive overload and have significantly throughout their lifespan who are just like really fit, and maybe Walter Michel's marshmallow test. You know, I would love to see if there's actually any crossover between that sort of mindset of delaying gratification and actually seeing results. And man, when it comes to exercise science, it's a tough one. It's a really tough one.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables there too with exercise.
People have different set points. People, you know, things change differently for different people. It's hard.
But I also think that, you know, the science moves slowly, and we've sort of settled into like we're 90% there of kind of understanding how this works. Mm-hmm. You know, diet and exercise. But the self-help industry doesn't want to settle in. They always want something new. You know, they need a new gimmick, a new shtick.
Yeah.
Right? But that's not how science works. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this next item's interesting. I wrote about it last week about biofuels. There was a study that came out, I don't know if you guys saw this, looking at the carbon count, you know, like how much carbon do biofuels absorb from the atmosphere and then release into the atmosphere. You know, I've never been a fan of biofuels as a method of reducing our carbon emissions. It seems like the benefit is pretty close to the line. And it also requires that we use land that we could otherwise be using to grow food. And so even if it may be over the line in terms of producing more energy than it consumes, I'm not sure that's really going to move the needle too much, you know, get us closer to our goal of reducing our CO2 emissions. In any case, this new study casts even further doubt on it. They were looking primarily at growing corn, you know, for corn ethanol for as a biofuel. Of course, these calculations all depend on what feedstock you're talking about. If you're using sugarcane, the numbers look a lot better. If we develop some hypothetical, you know, algae-based or whatever, you know, feedstock in the future, it may be fantastic. Who knows? But if we just focus on corn, which is the number one feedstock for biofuel in the U.S. right now, what the researchers did was they asked a different question than what has been asked previously. So one of the more common ways of evaluating the efficiency of a biofuel is called a life cycle analysis. I know we've talked about that on the show before, an LCA. And a life cycle analysis asks how much energy is put into creating a gallon of biofuel and how much energy do we get out of it. And for a while, it was kind of questionable whether or not we were even getting more energy out of, you know, the biofuel than we were putting into it. If you count, again, the entire life cycle, that's where the name comes from. So every bit of energy that goes into growing that corn, harvesting it, fertilizing it, converting it into biofuel, shipping it, et cetera. And then you finally get that gallon of ethanol to its where it's being used, and then you burn it. How much energy do you spend getting it there? And for a while, there were many analyses that argued that it was actually a net negative. You know, it costs more energy than you end up getting out of it at the end of the day. But over the last 20 years, 10 years, I think specifically, the process has gotten more and more efficient. It seems that now we do get net energy out of the biofuel, out of ethanol, than we put into it. But so these researchers are asking a different question. They're asking, well, what's the carbon balance of biofuels? Now, up to this point in life cycle analysis, the assumption is that when you grow the corn, the amount of carbon being absorbed from the atmosphere into the corn is the same as the amount of carbon that's released when you burn the ethanol back, you know, and release the CO2 into the atmosphere. So that the offset of growing the feedstock is 100% of what gets released into the atmosphere. But the author said, well, maybe that assumption is not correct of 100% offset, you know, from growing the feedstock versus burning the biofuel. So they calculated how much extra carbon would be absorbed from the atmosphere from growing all of the corn used to make biofuel, and then how much carbon would be released into the atmosphere from burning that biofuel. And according to their calculations, which are very complicated. I really couldn't parse it. I mean, we'll link to the paper if you want to dive in there. Good luck to you. It was a very technical paper, but this is their bottom line. So I'll read their conclusion. This is a quote. The assumption that biofuels are inherently carbon neutral is a premise of most climate-related fuel policies promulgated to date, including measures such as the LCFS and RFS that evaluate greenhouse gas impacts using life cycle modeling. However, this analysis found that the gains in CO2 uptake by feedstock were enough to offset biofuel-related biogenic CO2 emissions by only 37% over 2005 to 2013. That was their period of evaluation, showing that biofuel use fell well short of being carbon neutral even before considering process emissions. Now, if you take their 37% and plug that into the, you know, existing life cycle analysis of ethanol, corn, ethanol, biofuel, instead of the assumed 100%, what they conclude that growing biofuels, growing corn for biofuel, actually is a net increase in the amount of carbon released into the atmosphere. So, you know, by their analysis, if it's correct, you know, by these biofuels actually worsen CO2 release into the atmosphere.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man, that's crazy.
One question I could not answer. I could not find the answer to this, and that always makes me feel uncomfortable when I can't close the loop myself, at least conceptually, on what's going on here. If growing the corn only offsets 37% of the CO2 that gets released when you burn it, then where's the other 63% of the carbon coming from? Does that mean that, you know, 67% of the carbon in the ethanol did not come from the air into the corn? So where is that CO2 coming from? It has to come from somewhere. Now, the study, again, as far as I could tell, didn't look at that. They were just calculating the net carbon flow, you know, in and out of the biofuel. Some people commented that maybe it came from the soil, but you know, that's not true. The corn does not pick up carbon from the soil. If anything, it releases carbon into the soil. It probably comes from the fertilizer, the fossil fuel based fertilizer, but, that wasn't clear. I couldn't find any place in the paper that sort of discussed that explicitly. So, and it's interesting. It's a very complicated area. The whole idea of trying to track every bit of energy and every molecule of carbon in a complicated process like, you know, growing corn, turning it into ethanol, and shipping it and burning it and fertilizing it, all the things that go down, that go into doing that, is it's hard to track all that down. But it tells you how close things are when, you know, little assumptions that we make or things that we account for or don't account for make the difference between it being a net advantage or a net disadvantage. It's certainly not a home run. And I will say, and the authors did make this explicit, that their analysis didn't even consider the effect of the increased land use to grow all this corn to turn into biofuel. And because that, you know, turning a forest into farmland actually releases CO2 into the atmosphere. Yeah. So, and of course, there's only so much land. You know, as we, I know we discussed not too long ago on the show, we're actually using pretty much all the arable land on the earth to grow crops.
All of it?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, there's not much left. I mean, maybe a tiny bit here or there. All the best farmland is being used. You certainly can't significantly increase the amount of farmland we have to use to grow crops. So we do have to ask, you know, going forward, you know, if we imagine where is this going to be in 50 years or 100 years in terms of where we're getting our energy from, and also how are we growing enough food to feed the then what's there going to be 15 billion people or whatever. Obviously, the number's going to keep going up.
Bugs and kelp.
Yeah, I know we got to eat bugs.
Yep.
Lab grown meat.
Well, there's that.
Lab grown meat is not a source of energy. That is just converting energy into a form that we want to eat. But
yeah, we're going to be having to eat like all these algae blooms.
Yeah.
That are happening in the oceans. You know, we're going to have to start using the ocean to harvest more microorganisms and eating lower down on the food chain, I think.
Kellogg's brand algae flakes.
Yes.
Well, that's that. We're already, you know, getting a lot of our calories by overfishing the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ocean's in trouble.
I do think there will be technological breakthroughs that will change the nature of the game, but, you know, it's still, I don't think it's going to get us away from having to think about where all the molecules are coming from, you know, that we're using.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, that was a segue. I want you're going to tell us about using robots to build solar panels on the moon.
Yes, and maybe they can grow some meat up there too. A high school student has extended current thinking about space-based solar power generation to include auto-fabricating the solar cells on the moon and then inexpensively deploying them into Earth orbit. So he took it one step farther than most people have been thinking. So solar satellites are not new. Of course, the idea, you know, has been bandied about for decades. I remember hearing about this when I was a kid, and I've been waiting for them for so long. But it became especially in our face, I would say, in the 70s. And that was because of the oil crisis. People were talking about it. But inevitably, you know, the oil prices went down. And so the motivation to explore this idea more fully kind of ended as well. So, but now we've got global warming, and we've got this increasing push away from fossil fuels. So attention is now being increasingly focused on generating solar power in space and beaming it back to Earth as just something worth exploring and thinking about and seeing what can be done. Now, solar power in general, I think, and obviously makes a lot of sense. I think it was Elon Musk who said that basically we have a damn fusion generator in the sky, which is true. We can't, you know, get fusion working on the Earth, but we've got a proof of concept just 93 million miles away. And he's right. It's bathing. The sun is bathing us in orders of magnitude more power than even our grandkids could imagine using in their time. So solar cells on the ground, they of course make a lot of sense too. But when you think about it globally, you know, there's some interesting downsides to terrestrial solar power generation. So distributing the power, you know, is not easy. You have to get the power
you know, where it needs to be. There's, of course, the environmental impact, which needs to be taken into account. And of course, there's that little pesky issue of the sun disappearing for half your day. That's kind of annoying. And also
more than half.
Depending where you are.
If you include clouds. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I think what's the number? It's like 30% or something. There's a number about like what the efficiency is of a solar panel in terms of the percentage of all the time throughout the year that it's getting sunlight. And it's something like 30%.
Like 30%. Wow, yeah. Even worse. So another downside to terrestrial solar power. And then there's also battery storage, which is a big problem for this. So space, of course, has lots of advantages. Some you may not even be aware of. There's no weather to worry about. You don't have to worry about storms or clouds. There's a near constant sunlight. I mean, like upper 90 percentile. I mean, right? Unless the Earth gets in the way, you're going to bathe in photons. Also, with no atmosphere to filter through, we're talking 27% brighter. 27% brighter just because you're outside of the Earth. And distributing the power is actually relatively easy. Basically, all you need is a receiver, and you can potentially receive the power from the satellites. So that means that sending electricity to a village in developing countries would be almost a no-brainer as long as they had receivers. If there's disaster-stricken areas, bam, set up a receiver. You got tons of power. Some people say that the receiving equipment can be sent in just a couple of shipping containers, so not a huge deal. And another big thing about this is that you don't need batteries, because when you have space, when you have satellites in space sending you power, that's essentially continuous. So you don't necessarily need to store it because it's always going to be there. There's no nighttime that's going to screw you up. And this is one of the big problems, as I said, with the ground-based solar power. So, but of course, the big elephant in the room now, of course, is the big downside for space-based solar is, of course, the cost. And it's nasty. Lewis Weber, the guy who came up with this idea, calculates that I'm going to get into. He calculated that it would cost tens of trillions of dollars to send up any meaningful number of solar power satellites. And that sounds about right. You know, what is it? $10,000 a pound? Tens of trillions. Yeah, it's not a tiny amount of money. It's ridiculous. So the crux of the matter then is, what is his plan to mitigate the cost? And as Steve mentioned earlier, and in my intro, basically the idea is to send self-replicating machines to the moon. They or something else or bigger corporations would mine for the regolith for silicon, iron, aluminum, and turn that into the parts you need that the machines would then take and put into solar panels. Of course, you'd have to simplify things, he says. He said, instead of having 1,000 different types of screws, let's have 5. Instead of having different molds for different parts, let's have a 3D printer. So make it simple. Of course, a great idea especially when you're trying to build something on the moon. And then, of course, once that's complete, you launch the panels back to Earth. And because the moon's gravity is 1/6 of Earth's, that's a lot less money, a lot cheaper. Of course, there's some problems here, but I'll get to that in a second. But let me close this up. He says that he calculates a total cost of $10 billion. If you took that $10 billion and built them on the Earth and then launched them into space, you could power 150,000 homes. That's nice. That's a good number of houses. But he says, if you take that same $10 billion and do his moon idea, you could supply all the power that the Earth uses, not just 150,000 houses, but everything pretty much. So that's a dramatic comparison right there. He even claims that if it costs $100 billion and not $10 billion, the cost of generated electricity would be, get this, 1/1000th of a penny per kilowatt hour. 1/1000th of a penny, $0.00042 per kilowatt hour. If that's correct, that would just simply blow away any type of fossil fuel you can think of. So that's his argument. That's what he says. So, of course, the problems are, some of them are leaping to mind. Self-replicating robots obviously don't exist yet. And the engineering involved would be incredible, to say the least, to pull this off. $10 billion sounds very, very conservative to me. I think it's going to happen. I think it's too enticing and beneficial of an idea. We will pull it off at some point. I don't know when, but it's going to happen.
Bob, he also says that, but the research could get started for $350 million, which he says is the same amount of money that Americans spend on Halloween costumes for their pets.
For their pets, yes.
Wonderful for their quote. Pets. Wonderful
quote. I love when people pull out those weird stats.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
It's wonderful. But hey, dude, don't pick on Halloween, all right? Give me a break.
What's funny, is that a lot of times in a lot of different contexts, I've heard people compare the cost of whatever to the amount of money Americans spend on Halloween candy every year. For some reason, that's a big number, but it is interesting, but it's one of those things that's obviously deceptive because there's a lot of people. And, you know, whenever you start talking about how much money 300 million people are spending on anything, it's going to be a lot. It doesn't necessarily really put it into perspective for you. It's kind of deceptive. Well, but it's fun. Kind of, it's funny to make those kind of comparisons.
It is. What it puts into perspective, though, is how gargantuan Halloween actually is and deservedly. So, here's a tiny subset of Halloween, in quotes, and it's all about pets, and it's still a pretty big number. So, yeah, it's the best holiday ever. So now the other thing is that in terms of actually getting the robots the raw material acquired, from what I could tell, he seems to leave that part of the cost in the cost equation out. If I'm right, then that's a big piece to leave out. In one article I read, it said, I quote, "In terms of digging up lunar dust and refining it into usable parts, that might be a job for deep space industries and planetary resources, companies that are developing technologies to mine asteroids." Well, okay. So is that part of your $10 billion? It was hard to say. It doesn't seem that way. So that's a huge thing to not factor into your bottom line number, because that's huge. I mean, you get basically going to get a company on the moon or in asteroids and do the mining and turn it into materials that these machines can turn into panels. That's a big thing to leave out. And
21st century alchemy.
So I don't know. What do you guys think of this idea? I just think it's, you know, it's interesting, but just way premature.
I like the concept.
Isn't it common that when you're talking about something that's on such a huge scale, that's so ambitious, that you have to start putting money into doing the research and doing the engineering this early in the game?
Sure. And he admits that that much of that $10 billion would go for research and development because we don't have the technology.
So, I mean, every piece of the suggestion is reasonable in that, you know, having solar panels in Earth orbit, great idea. Building stuff on the moon rather than on the Earth because it's in a lower gravity, that's a great idea. Using self-replicating robots, okay, there's some, you know, concerns there, but as a way of manufacturing, that could work. Use 3D printing, wonderful. All those things are fine. It's just that, you know, as he admits, that this is a massive engineering project for technologies we don't yet have. And so that's kind of like, you know, like how to make $1 million in real estate. First you get $1 million. Then,
you know, buy a bunch of real estate.
First you invent all this new technology. And then once we do that, then, you know, it's easy. So, but we don't know how much, we never know how much it's going to cost to invent something that doesn't exist yet, you know? So that's, I think, the big unknown.
Right.
And history says that we usually massively underestimate, you know, how difficult it's going to be to do stuff. But it's also like the exact way that he's saying to do it that isn't necessarily the only way. And there are still pieces of this idea which still may be useful, like manufacturing stuff on the moon for Earth orbit is a good idea if you could, you know, figure out a way to do that. Putting solar panels in orbit is a good idea. I agree that I think we'll probably do that once we get to the point where the cost works out. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses?
Sounds like someone's tuning up an instrument or something, or it's a boat horn of some sort.
Oh, cool, Evan. That's interesting. It has kind of like that lazy over-the-water sound. You're right. It's actually – this is a wheel harp, and it's a musical instrument that has it has bowed strings that are controlled by a keyboard and a foot controller, right? Isn't that strange? But that's what happens when you press the keys. It actually bows a string. And this is similar to – Leonardo da Vinci's viola organista,
ooh,
which is a keyboard-operated string instrument. And it has the ability to continuously play these sounds as well because it's rubbing the strings with spinning wheels, right? Can you visualize that? It's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, last week, Todd Weekly, a friend of the show, sent that in. Thank you, Todd. And that was a wheel harp, guys. Listen to it. You can see this particular thing that I played was actually a part of a soundtrack to a movie. And look it up. It's pretty cool, and it plays really pretty creepy music.
All right. What do you got for this week, Jay?
All right. Check this out. I will explain this. This one, you're going to hear three different noises. They're all the same thing. That's a hint number one. But, you know, of course, it just sounds like there's more of it happening as we go along. I wanted to give you different samples of it just to give you a better chance of guessing what it is. Cool sound. Check this out. What the heck is it?
Sounds like one of those click trainers for your dog.
Click trainer? You mean the thing that shocks him into oblivion?
No, the thing you hold in your hand and click every time you know, like the...
The click, 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 yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that, but, you know, and that's not a good guess. But anyway, keep trying, Kara. I love you, so yeah. This is okay. We're good. All good. So please, if you have any guesses or awesome noises that you heard this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
The word this week is glycolysis. You guys know what glycolysis is? Not you, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I know what glycolic is.
Yes.
Yeah, glycolic. Glyco.
Glyco, good.
Is that turning sugar to glycogen in the muscles?
It's turning sugar into something, not glycogen, but...
You know, 2 months ago, I knew exactly what that damn word was.
A lot of people listening are going to say the same thing. So glycolysis is the metabolic pathway that breaks down glucose, as you said. That part of it is true. Starting with a single molecule of the simple sugar glucose, or, you know, C6H12O6, it undergoes 10 different enzymatic reactions to finally result in pyruvate, or CH3COCOO- and one hydrogen ion. Glycolysis is a type of catabolic pathway, also called glucose catabolism, meaning that it breaks down nutrients as opposed to an anabolic pathway, one that builds up. And it occurs in all living organisms, anaerobic and aerobic. The ultimate outcome of glycolysis is actually energy production in the form of ATP or adenosine triphosphate. It also can produce energy in the form of NADH. These are cellular energies. They're necessary, especially ATP is necessary for almost all metabolic reactions. In fact, it's actually required for glycolysis itself to occur. It takes 2 ATP to undergo glycolysis, which produces 4 ATP. So there's still a net gain of 2 there. After glycolysis, different processes can occur. You've probably heard of the citric acid cycle. Think real hard back to freshman bio, also called the Krebs cycle,
yeah,
which is followed by oxidative phosphorylation. That's where we have that proton pump and we see a ton of ATP produced. But when there's no oxygen available, glycolysis can actually lead to fermentation, like alcohol with yeast. Yes, yeast is a living organism and it undergoes this metabolic process, and that's how we make booze. Or lactic acid fermentation, which can actually occur in our own muscles when oxygen is low. So where did it come from? At least the word glycolysis. The process was actually elucidated first by Louis Pasteur in the 1800s, but he didn't quite have everything worked out. He was working with wine fermentation. And then after that, Edward Buchner, I really hope I'm pronouncing that right, he discovered the pathway's individual steps. He coined the term himself in the 1890s, and it would be 50 more years until all the steps were fully described. And glycolysis as a word is quite an easy one if you're a biology student, you're trying to remember what it means, because it's the literal joining of the French roots glyco, meaning sweet, and later specifically referring to a reference to sugar, and lysis, which means to break, release, loosen, or set free. So it follows that glycolysis is the pathway by which all living organisms break down sugar.
All right. Thank you, Kara.
Yep.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break. We just have one ad this week. It's a pre-recorded ad, which is a bit unusual, but, well, here it is.
College football is back in the biggest, most epic kickoff weekend ever. Top-ranked teams and top-tier matchups.
We have as good an opening week slate of games that I can ever remember.
Number 20 USC takes on the top-ranked defending champion Crimson Tide. Number 10 Notre Dame faces Texas. And number 11 Ole Miss battles the fourth-ranked Seminoles. The road to the college football playoff starts Labor Day weekend on ABC, ESPN, and streaming live on the ESPN app and Watch ESPN.
We're going to do one email. This is a email that comes from Aiden Carlton from Sydney, Australia, down under.
Been there?
Yeah, been there a couple of times.
Yeah.
This is a follow-up to our discussion of Proxima Centauri B. And Aiden writes, "Hi, crew. Firstly, I would like to say that I love the show. I listen to it at least one episode every day, which has meant that I am now on my third cycle of your entire catalog." That's impressive.
Wow.
Whoa. Yeah.
That's really impressive.
Thrice around.
"I wanted to write to make some corrections to the discussion about Proxima Centauri B. While these are relatively minor, they are common misconceptions when discussing exoplanets, and I hold the SGU to a much higher level than I do the mainstream media." As you should. All right. "Firstly, you were discussing the surface gravity of the object, and Steve mentioned that given the mass of the planet is 1.3 times that of the Earth, meaning that it is likely to have a surface gravity of between 1 and 1.3, and that the surface gravity would be less than 1.3. Given how little we know about this object, it is impossible to speculate even to that degree. The surface gravity depends on the mass and radius. Currently, the radius is completely unknown for this object. If the planet was slightly more dense than the Earth and had a similar radius, then the surface gravity would actually be higher than 1.3x. On the other hand, a less dense planet would have considerably lower gravity. It may be a little counterintuitive, but Earth, Venus, Uranus, and even Saturn have extremely similar surface gravity, despite a wide range of masses. Until we find out more, we really have no idea about the surface gravity." So before he goes on to the next point, let's talk about that. So he's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Although I think that, you know, he's saying that it's impossible to speculate. Well, no, you can't speculate. And what I was saying is that it's likely, because the astronomers think just statistically that an inner world like that is probably rocky. You know, it's probably not a gas giant, you know, that close in with that mass.
Hot Jupiter's notwithstanding.
Yeah, but I mean, but the hot Jupiters don't have a mass of 1.3 Earth masses. That's the point. With it, something that close and that mass is probably not gaseous, right? If it's a small rocky
world, on its orbit,
like the Earth, then yeah, there's a range of densities that it could have, and that's where the uncertainty comes in. But what I was essentially saying, that if we assume a similar density to Earth, you know, I was making the very specific point that the surface gravity does not increase linearly with the mass. You know, a world that was two Earth masses with the same exact density as the Earth would not have a surface gravity of two. It would have a surface gravity less than two because it would be bigger.
It's that's about mass and radius.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we don't know the density. So we could say we don't know the size. If we knew the size, we know the mass, we could calculate the density. And then we could estimate the surface gravity precisely. So yeah, we can only guess just based upon assumptions about what the world is, the density of the world is likely to be. But, you know, inner rocky planets so far tend to to fall within a fairly narrow range of densities. Saturn is, Saturn is, you know, extremely not dense.
It would float in water.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's density is less than that of water. All right, let's go on to his second point. More importantly is the discussion about the planet's overall mass. It was stated that the planet has a mass of 1.3 times that of Earth. This figure was widely circulated around the media, making the claim that this is Earth 2.0. However, as is often the case, it is a bit more complicated than that. This mass is actually a minimum mass. The detection method for this planet was the wobble method, as we mentioned, meaning we have no information on the orbital inclination. 1.3 Earth masses assumes that the planet orbits crossing directly between its parent star and the Earth, allowing the full force of its momentum to shift the planet star's position towards and away from the Earth. The planet, however, is likely to be inclined just given probability. As the inclination of the orbit increases, the mass of the planet must get bigger to wobble the parent star as much as it does in the direction of Earth. If, in fact, the planet is orbiting in line with the Earth, then it will actually transit the star. If it is detected as a transit event, then we are able to determine not only its overall mass more accurately, but by looking at the proportion of light blocked by the planet, we can also determine its radius and hence its surface gravity. If we determine that this is not a transiting exoplanet, then the minimum mass would increase as it is determined to have at least X inclination, where X is the angle determined by the radius of the orbit and the radius of the star. It will be interesting to see what the next few months of observation turns up. So what he's saying is, again, they detected this planet by the wobble method using Doppler shift, right? As the star goes away from us, it shifts red a little bit, and then it comes towards us, it shifts blue a little bit. And that happens in a regular period, so we could tell what the orbital period of the planet is. But of course, the planet is tugging the star in a random direction. It's not necessarily tugging it directly towards the Earth and directly away from the Earth. It would only do that if the orbit of the planet were exactly in line with the Earth.
Unlikely.
Yeah, which is unlikely, but that's where the 1.3 masses come from. And if the more it deviates from that plane being directly aimed at us, the more massive the planet would have to be to create the same wobble in the direction towards and away from the Earth. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it could be a lot more massive is what they're saying, essentially, than 1.3. 1.3 was a minimum, but then it got simplified in the reporting to it is 1.3 rather than it's at least 1.3. Which is interesting. But anyway, I thought, yeah, those details are interesting about exactly how, you know, what we know about the planet and how we know it. And, of course, if it does transit, our information about it will go way up. All right. Well, we have a great interview coming up with Seth Shostak, old friend of the show, to talk about more interesting stars and possibly planets, possibly aliens. We'll see. Who knows? We are joined now by Seth Shostak. Seth, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
Seth is a senior astronomer, and you are the director currently of the Center of the SETI Research.
Well, I'm not, because we don't have a Center for SETI Research now. It's all been combined into one giant amalgamated research organization. So just call me senior astronomer. It's appropriate for my age anyway.
I got you. So somebody needs to update your Wikipedia page.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I never have looked at it, so I don't know. Yeah.
So there's a couple of things I wanted to chat with you about this evening. We'll start with HD164595, which is the recent signal of interest that has sort of been presented to the SETI community. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, this is the result of a bizarre email that I received and many other SETI colleagues also received last weekend. Okay, so it's Saturday night, and you know I'm doing something productive like playing solitaire on my computer. I'm not quite sure what I was doing, but this email came in, and it was from an Italian physicist that we know who's in the SETI community, and he said, "By the way, do you guys know about this Russian signal? I was in Moscow, you know, 2 years ago, and they were talking about it, and well, here it is, and it should be followed up." So, you know, he sent some information. It looked very interesting. Well, I don't know whether I would have done anything about it. I didn't do anything about it that night. I thought, interesting, but there's no real info about it. Someone wrote a blog entry on a website about this signal. Apparently, he had been notified as well. And suddenly, the world kind of exploded, at least the media part of the world exploded, because, hey, here's ET on the line. So that's how it began.
Yes, that's a little unusual because it just sort of came through the back door. And also, it was like 2 years old, and why were they sitting on it for 2 years?
Well, the plot actually said May 2015. So, you know, the chronology is very difficult to ascertain because the Russians themselves have said, oh, well, you know, during the Soviet period. Well, the Soviet period kind of predates 2015 or 2014. So I don't know what they're trying to say there. That may be it may be a lost in translation problem. But indeed, there was a signal, and you know the thing about it was it seemed to be coming from the direction of the star HD164595, better known as Bob. Anyhow, this star is 95 light years away, so it isn't terribly far, and it's already known to have at least one planet. It's not a very habitable planet, but it has a planet. There are probably other planets there. Who knows? It could be the aliens trying to get in touch. So what do you do? Do you remain cynical and say, you know, it's probably interference, or you actually spend some telescope time looking at this thing, and we chose for the latter.
So you pointed to the Allen array that you're using?
We did, the Allen Telescope Array, yeah, in Northern California, about 300 miles north of San Francisco. And we spent two nights on it, and we're observing it now, I think until 2 this morning. But yes, we invested the telescope time.
And you found nothing so far?
We found nothing. Yeah, and we had enough sensitivity to find the signal that was reported by the Russians, because they gave an indication of the strength of the signal, from which, by the way, you can work backwards and compute how powerful their transmitter would have to be. But, you know, that aside, we were sure that we could see it, and we did not. We did not.
You mentioned that you could calculate how big the transmitter would have to be. So give us an idea. Like, what are we talking about?
Well, as I say, it's fairly simple. You know, you see what is the strength of the signal falling on the Earth. You know that because the Russians tell you that. And then you say, okay, let's assume it's coming from a planet around this star 95 light years away. We just use some high school physics and work it backwards. And it turns out that if they were broadcasting this signal in all directions, right, you know, it's kind of like your local TV station does, they just broadcast in all directions, then the amount of power they would need for us to get that signal would have been 100 billion billion watts. Now, that's more than a couple of, AA batteries. I mean, that's a lot of power.
And, it's a lot of juice.
Yeah. Well, okay, but, you know, I tried not to be too provincial and begrudge the aliens, you know, energy capability, because maybe they build a giant Dyson sphere. I mean, who knows? If they're 100,000 years more advanced than we are, maybe they have access to that kind of energy. Who knows? But it is very big. Now, if for some reason they were targeting Earth, and it's hard to think of a reason because, after all, they haven't picked up our early TV or radar or any of that stuff yet. They just haven't. So they don't know enough to say, well, there's obviously some intelligence down there. We'll send them a message. No, they don't know that. So, you know, if they're targeting us, it's on the basis of what? I don't know. They probably have seen the oxygen in our atmosphere and know there's photosynthesis here. But, you know, how often do you want to get in touch with the plants? So, let's assume that they had some reason to target the Earth, at least for a while. Then the power requirements go down depending on how big an antenna they use to focus their energy.
Yeah, that's right. Have they been doing this for a billion years? Like every 1,000 years or so, they send us a ping.
Yeah, that might make sense. So that's 1,000 pings, and they still haven't gotten a response. The whole story actually came to a head today. And that's because the Russians, perhaps stung by the fact that this story has become enormously popular, decide they better say something, and they put out the Russian Academy of Sciences. They put out a statement saying that, well, to the best of their knowledge, this was just a military satellite, the transmissions from a military satellite getting into the telescope beam.
Yeah, but I was reading those reports as well, and it was very unclear why they concluded that. I couldn't tell if they had some positive reason to say that or if this was just because they haven't repeated the signal. They haven't picked up any repetition of it.
Yeah, I don't know. There were several statements from the Russians, actually. The one, you know, saying, well, this was the result of observations made during the Soviet era. Well, that's like, what, 25 years ago or something like that. I mean, and then they're saying, oh, no, it was actually 2015, but it was a military satellite. It's actually quite hard to tell when you get interference like that, because we get it all the time. With the Allen Telescope Array, you can't point it at anything without picking up signals, you know, at the rate of several a minute. Right. And they're almost all of them are satellites, actually.
And that is the process, right? You see a signal and then you go through a process of eliminating terrestrial or known sources or known astronomical sources, correct?
Right. And in fact, the gold standard for deciding, hey, Igor, is this, you know, the real deal or is it not, is if you find a signal, you move the telescope a little bit away from the star system that you're aiming at. And see if the signal goes away, as it should, if the signal's really coming from that star system. But if it's not coming from that star system, if it's just, you know, a satellite passing overhead, it really doesn't matter where you aim the telescope, because the signal will be so strong that you'll pick it up no matter where you aim. It's like somebody turning on their cell phone in a movie theater. You can see the light no matter where you're sitting. So, you know, I suspect that what happened, but this is just a supposition, is that the Russians either didn't look at the data right away, or they looked at it and decided, you know, they knew it was a satellite anyhow, but, you know, they didn't tell everyone. I mean, there was something went awry with the procedure, because normally if you pick up a signal and you think this might be ET, you call up somebody at another observatory and say, you guys look
Makes
at
sense.
It. And they didn't do mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, this isn't one to get too excited about.
I don't think so.
Yeah, let's shift over to something that I think is genuinely interesting. We've talked about it before on the show, but I wanted to get your feedback on this. What's being called Tabby's star, or the most mysterious star in the galaxy. Tell us about that.
Yes, and it was found by a group headed up by Tabitha Bajoyan. I know I mispronounced her name, but she tells
Boyajian, me Bajoyan, probably.
Well, it could be. She says she mispronounces it herself. She's at Yale there, so you know, probably not very far from where you guys are.
Right.
And in the astronomy department, this is a star that was observed by the Kepler telescope, the space telescope Kepler, run by NASA, and which you know is essentially a big light meter in space, just looking at the brightness of 150,000 stars to see if any of them get dim occasionally because of planets passing in front. And it's found thousands of planets, by the way. But this star didn't have planets going around it, not that they could see with Kepler. But it did dim occasionally, not in a regular way, but in a rather irregular way. And one of those dips in brightness was like 22%. Now imagine if the sun were to dim by 22% for a few hours or a few days.
You'd notice it.
You would definitely notice that. Okay. So, you know, that's not a planet. I mean, even Jupiter wouldn't dim the sun by more than 1%. So this is enormous. So the question is, what's going on here? And the answer to that question is, nobody knows. There have been a whole raft of suggestions. Everything from comet dust to, well, an alien megastructure. In other words, there's some planet there with a high-tech society, and they've built this giant structure, kind of a Dyson sphere, you know, just tons and tons of solar panels orbiting in space that supply their energy needs. And, of course, occasionally, you know, a phalanx of these solar panels will block light from the sun, and that's what this is. But there's not evidence yet that can prove one way or the other exactly what this thing is. So it remains mysterious.
From my understanding, at this point in time, obviously there's no evidence that it's aliens, right? This is any kind of alien phenomenon. And it's always a good rule of thumb when we encounter something weird or new or unknown that it's probably a natural phenomenon that we're just not familiar with or something bizarre. I mean, there's so many stars out there. There's got to be a lot of unique or unusual or unlikely situations, you know. We're sampling so many stars, you know, we're going to find rare stuff. But it is intriguing that, as far as I could tell, and tell me what you think about this, so no hypothesis so far about what natural phenomenon might be causing this dip in the star really holds up to the evidence. So essentially, we don't even have candidate hypotheses right now that have not been ruled out. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think your take on it is accurate. I mean, this is a short laundry list in Tabby's paper about this star. It didn't include alien megastructures, by the way, but, you know, of things that might be causing this dip. And none of them looks terribly, I don't know, you probably wouldn't put a stack of poker chips on any of them. And as you say, attempts to verify them, which mostly involve using big optical telescopes to see if you see any infrared radiation coming from this star. That would tell you that there's some sort of, you know, dust there in the way, because dust is something mm-hmm. that does block light. So if you had a big, you know, cloud of dust that for some reason was in orbit about this star, that could do it. But the dust itself would get warm, maybe to, you know, kind of like room temperature, and that would emit a lot of infrared that maybe you could pick up. They haven't found it yet, but I think the larger point is this, and you did allude to it. You know, astronomers occasionally do find something new in the sky. In fact, that's the good thing about astronomy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, and whatever it is, you know, a little bit bizarre, whether it's fluctuating quasars or pulsars or whatever, you know, the first explanation that a lot of people will glom onto is to say, you know what, it's aliens. Well, okay, it might be aliens, but it never has been. So I think that the safe bet is that this isn't aliens either, but, you know, you don't know. I think what will happen, if I had to bet a nickel on this, is that within a year or so, people will find a second example of a star that does this sort of thing, and then you find a third one very quickly. And, you know, after you found a couple of them, you know that it's a natural phenomenon, and then some theoretician mm-hmm. will come up with what's going on.
Why can't they all be Dyson spheres?
Yeah, they could. They could. But, you know, it begins to strain credulity at some point.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, but I think from reading what other astronomers say about it, everyone's very conservative and careful to say it's probably not aliens, but you can kind of also tell they're all hoping it is aliens. Of course, because why not, right? And it's like, it's okay, it's probably not aliens, but we can't take it off the list yet. And anything where you can't take aliens off the list yet is interesting. It's compelling, you know? And I think that when we do discover aliens, again, I'm happy to hear your thoughts on this, it's going to be one of the, it's not going to be like a press release where, hey, we found aliens. It's going to be this long simmering story that's going to take years to unfold. And we'll probably start something like this, where there's a mystery and then we rule things out. We rule more things out and there's more intriguing information. Then slowly, 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 we're going to build a picture where astronomers will start to say, maybe it is aliens. Who knows? Do you agree with that?
What you said. Absolutely. Absolutely. People have this, I don't know, this idea, and I think it probably comes from the movies, that, you know, we're going to be sitting around here looking bored. Well, that part might be accurate. But then, you know, suddenly, beep and beep and beep, you know, a klaxon sounds, red lights start swinging around the ceiling. And, you know, everybody jumps up from their chair, and then they start calling the press and so forth. We found it. Well, it doesn't work that way. Just as you say, I mean, you just get a signal that is kind of intriguing, or you find something in the sky that's a little puzzling. It's, as Isaac Asimov once said, the most important words are not eureka, but that's funny. So yeah. that may be very well. And I don't know that it'll take years to prove it. That part might not be quite so pessimistic. I think okay. But it will certainly take weeks. It'll take weeks. And we know from experience that in all that time, because there's no policy of secrecy here, in all that time, people will be writing blogs and tweeting and everything else. It'll be the media will be on top of this story really quickly.
The thing about that's cool about Tabby Stars, no matter what it turns out to be, it's going to be interesting.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's been my pleasure. Really, it has.
Thanks.
Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake-a-rooney. We have a theme this week. Let me tell you about the theme. Let me tell you how
come
this came
on.
Up. So, yeah, we're recording the show a little early this week because we have to get everything ready at Dragon Con. But when the show comes out, we'll be at Dragon Con. So I have a full day of work, and I'm trying to prepare for science or fiction, and it's a horrifically busy day, and I'm, like, running out of time. And then I get an email from a listener named Caroline, who sends me a fully formed science or fiction segment.
No way.
Yeah, so thank you, Caroline, for doing – I mean, I reconfigured the information that she sent to me into more typical format that I use.
Stephenese.
but she provided most of the information that I used for the science or fiction. So thank you, Caroline. Perfect timing.
This may be a precedent.
Perfect timing.
Why wasn't there a CC on there?
Yeah, so I checked. Didn't send it. She thoughtfully only sent it to me. The theme is the ancient Olympic Games because she liked our segment on the modern Olympic Games and thought that we could use some information about the ancient Olympic Games.
Damn you, Caroline.
I agree. And there's four items because there was a lot of information in there, so four items. Suck it up. Okay, here we go.
Sucking.
Item number one. For much of the ancient Olympic Games, athletes and their coaches were nude. Item number two. The term Olympiad refers to a period of 4 years and was used by the Greeks in dating events. Item number three. The first recorded Olympic Games consisted of only a single competition, a marathon race of 26.219 miles. And item number four, the ancient Olympic Games were held every 4 years for about 1,200 years, but possibly longer. Evan, go first. I believe you volunteered last week.
I did. Yes, I'm so foolish that way.
There's four items here, by the way.
I know. An extra chance to get it wrong. For much of the ancient Olympic Games, athletes and their coaches were nude. I'll have a feeling that this one will wind up being true, for no other reason than who needs all those encumbrances, like, you know, smocks and togas and golden leaf in your hair and stuff and whatever else they used to wear. So I'm not surprised at that. Next, the term Olympiad refers to a period of 4 years. Olympiad, well, I had not heard that before. So, I don't know. This one really could be the fiction. I think that might be fiction. Next, the first Olympic Games, the first recorded Olympic Games, consisted of a single competition, the marathon, 26.219 miles. I'm also thinking this one's fiction. One event only does an Olympics not make, as Yoda once said. And then the last one is the games were held every 4 years for 1,200 years. So I guess it would help to know when the ancient Olympics really began. And that might help put that in perspective. 1,200 years seems like a long time and possibly longer. Well, I'm leaning towards, I think three of these are fiction. Therefore, I have to just flip my three-sided coin and say, I think it's the marathon one. I can't believe that it would have been called Olympic Games because of a marathon race, just because it was a marathon race. Why call it Olympics? So I don't see the connection there. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
For much of the ancient Olympic Games, athletes and their coaches were nude. I want that to be true. The term Olympiad refers to a period of 4 years and was used by the Greeks in dating events. The first recorded Olympic Games consisted of only a single competition, a marathon race. Evan thinks that's the fiction. And the ancient Olympic Games were held every 4 years for about 1,200 years, but possibly longer. This one sticks out to me as the fiction. I don't think the Olympics always happened. I think there have been times when the Olympics didn't happen. And so I'm going to have to go with number four, even though any of the other ones could be fiction quite easily. But I'm going to say that there have been times when the Olympics did not take place.
Okay, Bob. Naked coaches and athletes. I don't know. I think I remember reading something about that. So I'm going to go with that one.
Oh, I'm sure you did, Bob.
Oh, yeah, baby. Let's see. 4 years. An Olympiad means 4 years. I'm not sure about that one. Single competition, a marathon. That kind of rings a bell. I mean, it's all I got. I can go by is these ancient memories that may or may not be completely false. The every 4 years for 1,200 years, but possibly longer. Initially, that sounded crazy long, but I'm going to say that one is science because it just seems like way too much to me. And the possibly longer, I think, is kind of a little bit of a giveaway for me. I mean, the only thing I can think of now is that Olympiad referring to a period of 4 years. I'm going to say that's fiction. Never heard of that.
Whoa.
And Jay.
Athletes, I'm pretty sure, were nude. At least that's what I saw on TV.
The name of that show.
But it wasn't original.
In Rio? Oh.
No, but I don't know if the coaches were nude. Like, what? Like, okay, let's go to the Olympics. Let's get naked. I don't know.
You know how the coaches in baseball wear the baseball uniforms? You know, same thing.
Who else got nude, you know? Anyway, the term Olympiad refers to 4 years. Yes. 4 years. Olympiad. Yes. That's science. First recorded Olympic Games consisted of only a single competition, the marathon race. I don't know about that one. The first, and then here's the sneaky thing. The first recorded Olympic Games, which ones are we talking about? The ones that happened, you know, a couple thousand years ago or the modern?
These are all ancient, Jay.
They're all ancient. Yeah. All of it.
Well, okay then. I don't really think that that's all they did. They had all sorts of stuff going on. Chariot races, and they throw these big discs, and they had to fight Cyclops.
And the Scylla and Charybdis.
Yeah, yeah. Right? You saw that
and
on TV.
Testicles.
Yeah.
The mighty Testicles.
The ancient Olympic Games were held every 4 years for about 1,200 years, but possibly longer. I don't know. Okay. That one, I think I agree with Kara. Yeah, I don't know. Huh? I'm just going to say that the first one wasn't just a marathon because marathon was more of a fable / maybe a true story, but not a demigod type of deal. But I don't think that one is science. I think that one's fake.
Oh, good. I'm not alone.
Okay. So Bob said that the Olympiad being 4 years was fake. Jay and Evan, that marathon was fake. And Kara, the 1,200 years. Did I get that right?
Yeah, the final one.
Yeah. So you all agree on the first one. For much of the ancient Olympic Games, athletes and their coaches were nude.
Why did we all agree on that?
All agreed that that one is science. And that one is science.
Yay.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere.
Do you know why that was the case? I said for much of the Olympic Games, not for all the games. I think initially they wore loincloths, but then they sort of phased out.
To keep from cheating?
Anti-chafing policy?
Specifically, the coaches were made to remove their clothing before entering the stadium because women were not allowed at the Olympic Games. There were certain special events for women, but the main competitions that women were not allowed to view them. They weren't allowed to look at the male athletes. And there was this one historical case of a mother who disguised herself as her son's coach so she could watch him race. And so they said, okay, from now on, all the coaches have to be naked so we know they're not women in disguise.
That's so effed
up. So if you're not packing, you're sent packing?
Yeah, basically. The reason why the athletes were naked is interesting. It's not completely known. You know, obviously we're talking about a long time ago. But part of the idea was that the games were a celebration of the body, of the human body.
Oh, see, now it's starting to make sense.
Yeah,
apparently the male body only.
They wanted to showcase off the olive-oiled male body. You know, athletic bodies. That was, and only other guys could look at them. So that I think that puts things into perspective.
Yeah, because really, guys really appreciated that form.
Because it was ancient Greece, you know. That's how they rolled. So that one is science.
That leapfrog competition is popular.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to number two. The term Olympiad refers to a period of 4 years and was used by the Greeks in dating events. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. And this one is science. This one is also science. Sorry, Bob. So, do you know where the term Olympic Games comes from?
Nope. Well, Mount Olympus, so the gods.
4 year games.
Yeah, they didn't take place on Mount Olympus, but that's a good guess.
I understand that. But you know, the concept of it being a godly achievement or something.
No, it was the valley, the Olympic Valley. It was a valley named Olympus. It was near some city. And, That was the location of the games, and then actually there were multiple games. This is, I guess, the most popular one, but because it was held every 4 years, I think Olympiad came to mean every 4 years, and then they started use the Olympic Games were such a important event in ancient times that the Greeks actually started to use it to tell time, you know, and that they marked their calendar by the Olympics. And they used Olympiad as a period of 4 years, which became the standard, which is interesting.
Really?
Yes, Olympiad. Yeah, Olympiad refers to a period of 4 years. All right, let's move on. The first recorded Olympic Games consisted of only a single competition, a marathon race of 26.219 miles. Evan and Jay think this one is the fiction. Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is... the fiction.
The fiction.
Good work, boys.
Yes. Fiction.
No.
That sounded painful, Kevin.
Even though the marathon race and the Olympic Games were both ancient events, they actually never occurred together. The marathon was never run at the ancient Olympics. They were only included in the modern Olympics. Never the ancient Olympics. Now, do you know why a marathon race is 26.219 miles?
Is that the distance from Marathon to Athens?
Close. It's the distance from the city of Marathon to the Olympic Stadium.
Olympic Stadium, yep.
To the Olympic Stadium,
okay. To celebrate the a historical event.
Historical events, yep.
When a rider had to warn them of an impending attack of some sort, so he ran the 26 miles.
Yes, the run Pheidippides.
Pheidippides.
A day runner who, according to Herodotus, ran from Athens to Sparta to announce the invasion of Greece by the Persians at Marathon in 490 BC.
And dropped dead afterwards, I heard.
No, he didn't. That was a myth.
That's the rumor. Yeah, that's the myth.
Yeah, he didn't drop dead afterwards. Now, but Jay, you said that you doubted the first Olympics only had a single event, but in fact, they did only have a single event. It just wasn't
chariot racing.
Nope.
Disc throwing.
The foot race. Just a foot race.
Just running.
Yeah, running.
Okay.
Like 600
from
feet.
From here to there.
600 foot race. I'll list you the ancient games. There weren't that many. The events were the foot race. That was the first one. The chariot race. The chariot race, by the way, was the only competition that women could enter. They couldn't ride the chariots, but they could enter their horses in the chariot race.
So I was right. Chariot race was there.
That was the only one that women could win. Okay. Again, there were other events that women would do, but I mean of the main competitions. The discus throw, jumping, and then running in armor. That was it.
Wow. Ugh. Running in armor is so hard, they put it in there. Running in armor.
Yeah.
You know what's harder? Swimming in armor.
But all those statues, I think the reason why it was so easy to believe that the games were held naked is because all those statues of like people throwing discs and stuff, they're naked.
Yeah. That's funny.
Like the famous one, the Discobolus, that famous 5th century BC.
Yeah, he's bent over kind of.
Discus thrower, yeah. He's naked in there.
I used to think when I was younger, okay, you know, I am much older than I was when I thought this, that a lot of the ancient statues, like the Greece,
Greek.
Thank you. A lot of those ancient Grecian salads, statues and, you know, ancient Rome, I thought that they made them without arms.
Oh, yeah.
Hello. They look kind of cool. But no, then you find out the arms fell off because that's the weak spots.
Yeah, that's why they're called busted.
So good. Oh, it hurts.
That made the whole night worth it for me.
Yeah. All right. All this means
that Jay and Evan won. Good night, everybody.
Occasionally funny. That number four, the ancient Olympic Games were held every 4 years for about 1,200 years, but possibly longer, is science. That's a long freaking time.
It is. That's a very long time.
1,200 years. Imagine a tradition going on for 1,200 years.
Yeah.
That is a long time. When do you guys think the games started?
Oh my gosh.
Wait, the original games?
Yeah, the ancient topic of the whole science fiction. When was it first?
No, but you asked a question that didn't have to for crying out loud. All right, when do I think they originally started?
I don't understand your confusion.
No, because there's the modern Olympics and the ancient Olympics. And you could have been asking either one. I'm just trying to get the question correct.
I don't know, roughly 900 BC or BCE, yeah, whatever the hell.
Probably 600 or 700 BC.
Yeah, Bob, you're pretty close. 776 BC or BCE. But that's the first, believed to be the first games. But there are pieces of evidence that suggest there may have been games held before then, like the medals that they would give, like these, like actually these little three-legged stands. You know, they would give to the victors. They found ones that are older than that. So they may have had roots going back even deeper than that, but that's not fully known. And then it lasted until when?
Well, the fall of Rome, roughly.
Well, I mean, what, if you do math, it's like three or four.
I thought you were saying the fall.
400 AD.
Until the fall.
Right.
The fall.
What killed the ancient Olympics was Christianity. So it was when Rome basically took over, they continued the tradition of the Olympic Games, which were hugely important. I mean, this is, you know, imagine something, a tradition that went on for that long. It was true that the victors would only get like wreaths of different kinds of leaves, either olive leaves or other kinds of leaves. But they would, you know, return to their city where they came from, and they would be given a fortune.
Oh, heroes. Yeah, welcome. Yeah,
exactly. It was used, then it became very politically important. You know, it was used to assert the dominance of your region or your city, state, or whatever. You know, it became a very huge political affair. 394, Theodosius I banned all pagan festivals, including the Olympic Games.
Wow. I mean, you got to think.
Yeah.
He didn't even like the Olympics, you know?
I'd say it ended a 1,200 year or whatever tradition.
That's gone.
Okay, Evan, actually, your quote this week, by total coincidence, is quite appropriate.
Total coincidence? Can you believe it? I don't know. I think Venus and Jupiter are aligned or something tonight. I think they are. There should be no element of slavery in learning. Enforced exercise does no harm to the body, but enforced learning will not stay in the mind. So avoid compulsion and let your children's lessons take the form of play. And those are the words of Plato.
Plato. I like that. I mean, the idea is like learning should be self-motivated, basically. If you force somebody to sit and learn, it's not going to really work, which I think there's certainly an element of truth to that, although that is the basis of our entire educational system.
Yeah, right. You will sit here and learn.
You think, but in the context of learning science, I mean, how much better is it to learn science in such a way that it is absolutely a joy,
sure,
and a wonder, and opens up your imagination and your, you know, just let your mind sort of flow with it as you learn the facts that you need to learn, yeah, as you go along. But how it's done is so important and will affect your retention of the information.
Of course,
no doubt, yeah, about it.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure,
thank you, sir.
Thanks, Doc.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.